Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. U.S. Rep. Jim Jordan is facing accusations that he knew wrestlers at Ohio State were being sexually assaulted. The Republican had been an assistant wrestling coach when former athletes say they went to him with complaints about Dr. Richard Strauss. Jordan has denied the allegations, and Ohio State has opened a formal investigation. Joining us for our weekly reporter roundtable is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Hi.
Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Good morning.
And Associated Press Columbus correspondent Julie Carr Smythe. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So I leave for a week and all kinds of news.
Oh, boy.
It was a newsier week than we want in the summer.
Summer's never not newsy anymore. I remember the olden days when you actually could take a vacation. So we know there's always going to be something breaking, but the Jordan story was pretty unexpected, right?
Right.
Julie Carr Smythe, what's going on?
So this doctor, Richard Strauss, who has died and was the team doctor for the wrestling team at Ohio State back in the 90s when Jim Jordan was assistant wrestling coach. Some of the folks who are coming forward are saying, oh, of course Jim Jordan knew. Everybody knew. And Jordan himself had been out at some, public appearances, fairs and whatnot, and said, absolutely not. If I had known, I would have told someone. But then there was this weird inconsistency where his office also had come forward and said, no, we've not been contacted by investigators. And the investigators said, yes, actually, we did contact him. So what we got was a kind of a clarification on that, because they released the documents that showed that emails did indeed get sent to Jim Jordan, but they were sent to a non-existent U.S. House email account. So the investigators had tried to reach out to him in May. They followed up, they say, with a phone call in June. His office is maintaining none of that got through.
Well, be that as it may, he is also denying any knowledge of the sexual assaults, or the alleged sexual assaults, I should say, by this now deceased doctor, right?
That's right. He says absolutely he knew nothing about it, and is willing to compromise. But more and more people are coming out. The AP had a story last week. We had seven people saying that during exams, Dr. Strauss was, it was an appropriate type contact. You go in for a stomach ache, maybe you'd have a groin exam or whatever, that he was adding these groin exams no matter what was happening. And, we're still trying to piece together.
You never know when you're going to find a hernia, right?
So, right, yeah. Right. And so Ohio State has actually interviewed about 150 people and continues to reach out, obviously, because if you look at the case of Larry Nassar up at University of Michigan.
Michigan State,
yep. That was extremely expensive for them. $400 million or something like that was the settlement. So I think that Ohio State is the one kind of with a deep pocket here trying to get ahead of this. It's weird to me that Jim Jordan has decided to deny and deflect on this. And why, for some reason, the day that came out, he wouldn't have come forward with, I know I was a wrestling coach. I'd love to talk to investigators and have his chief of staff call them and just get that over with. I don't know if that was a strategy or if that's just the truth. And he was waiting to hear whether he needed to be interviewed or not.
He says that he is now being accused of this because of his persistent questions to Rod Rosenstein, the assistant attorney general, and who's considered to be sort of the origin of the Russia probe in Washington. Andy Chow, anything to that?
Well, that's been the argument from the conservatives and people who are defending Jim Jordan, that this is all coming out and being made a big deal because Jim Jordan is running for re-election, maybe seeking the being the next Speaker of the House. So he says that this is sort of politically bent. And Jim Jordan has built up a profile of as being a big supporter of President Trump and a big opponent of the Russia investigation. However, I mean, this investigation surfaced a few months ago, and I think Jim Jordan did sort of answer preliminary questions back then. But now what's happening is that we're hearing from wrestlers on the team who are trying to talk about sort of the makeup of the team and the makeup of how people communicated things. And with a team or a tight-knit community, they're saying, of course, people know things and of course, people hear things.
Yeah. What do you kind of affect? I mean, is it going to have an impact on what he's able to do in Washington, Jim Siegel?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it's going to be impossible to ignore this. I mean, now I don't know. Again, I'm not going to argue that, you know, Jim Jordan is right or wrong. But when seven people come out on the record using their names, mm-hmm. saying that even some who say they really love you, some of these folks have come out and said they're big Jim Jordan supporters, but they say there is no way he didn't know. And to understand some of this, I mean, you have to have some understanding of what a locker room is like. And I'm sure Andy could talk about this as well. I mean, a locker room atmosphere, it's a different place than the norm. Things that would be way outside the norms in a traditional public setting are kind of sometimes laughed off, sometimes dismissed, made fun of in a locker room setting. And locker room, I'm not just using as the physical place of a locker room. I'm talking about it
for all the sports broader team thing.
Yes, yeah. As a broader, you know, term for sport. You know, mm-hmm. the cohesiveness of a sports team and so. It is, you know, it the more people that come forward, the harder it is to believe that Jim Jordan did not know what was going on and have a pretty good idea, not only not know, but that he had a good idea of what was going on. And just at the time, he didn't feel it was, you know, maybe he just didn't feel it rose to some level of needing to, you know, to report it because, like I said, in these kind of situations, these types of circumstances, especially back then, these things can be sort of brushed off. But that does not mean that it's not going to make it much more difficult for him as the congressional attack dog to continue to fill that role when this is hanging over his head and witnesses can fire back at him now and simply say, you know, bring this up.
Right. I did. I will say I interviewed someone from the team last week who defended Jordan on this and basically said, you know, number one, and the President Trump said the same thing. People say about Jim Jordan, he's just one of the best people I've known. He would never hide this kind of thing. And what this person said is he's very Christian and religious, and mm-hmm. probably it was, if anything, outside of his realm of thinking that he would imagine the kind of things that Strauss is now being accused of going on. And he himself was examined by Strauss, as were a number of the people or everybody who has come forward so far. And many people talk about not having any awkward interactions with Strauss. I mean, he was described to me as someone who was kind of a weird duck, who was odd. He kind of hung out with the team, invited them to his house and other things. And, you know, one of the excuses that we're hearing, and it's common in these sort of hashtag Me Too situations now, is people will say, well, they couldn't have been victimized because they were laughing about it, or they couldn't have been victimized because they hung out with that person socially, and therefore that doesn't make any sense.
But of course, we know that's not, it's not that simple.
Yeah,
it's not an either or proposition.
And I agree with Jim on the culture, the locker room culture, and hopefully these types of situations can shed a light on the danger of that sort of environment where things are said and they're laughed off and not taken seriously. And I think sometimes athletes feel like they don't have an avenue to report things. So they feel like if they say it sort of glibly, that maybe they're reaching out in some way. And we are hearing more and more of stories like this. And we already talked about MSU, the Penn State scandal with Jerry Sandusky. So, yeah, it again, we're not here to talk about what Jim Jordan did or did not know, but there is some sort of – there is a culture with sports teams of somewhat laughing off things that maybe should be taken more seriously.
Right. I mean, if you rock the boat, if you do things that are – you know, if you – you know, if you report something like this to suddenly it goes, you know, there's a saying that this stays in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common saying among sports teams. It stays in the locker room. So if all of a sudden you take these allegations outside the locker room to authorities, to, you know, university officials, or you raise the level of it, there is a fear, and it's a very real fear. You will be ostracized by your mm-hmm. teammates, your coaches. You will lose your scholarship,
mm-hmm.
lose respect of those you spend a lot of time with. And these are not folks you hang out with for an hour or two every week. I mean, you're living together, you're training together, you're playing together. And so it's a big deal.
We should remember, too, that decades of what they called a sexualized culture was revealed at the Ohio State marching band. And it came forward because of, you know, mandatory Title IX reporting, a parent of a female band member who felt that it was inappropriate what was happening in terms of, you know, sexualized nicknames that were being given to kids, skits they had to do, traditions that through months and months of those lawsuits and investigations, people still held very dear mm-hmm. and defended. Mm-hmm. So I think that these are cultures that this is just a new era. I mean, since Harvey Weinstein, it's empowered people to say, is this appropriate? And to talk about things that have been hidden for many decades.
And you still hear of that marching band case, you still hear former marching band members vilifying the person who came out and said something.
You mm-hmm. do. Sexualized atmosphere is different, though, than sexual assault. And my recollection and I'm not passing judgment on what sexualized atmosphere means, but it's different than being in an examination room with a doctor where you feel you're not in control and they're
right. When you go in for strep throat and he tells you to drop your drawers,
right.
I mean that's way different
right.
than making jokes and things.
But I've also heard some confusion from people about molestation of males. Versus females, that it's, you know, when you molest a female, you penetrate them. And if a doctor didn't penetrate this male, was that molestation? I think there's a lot of confusion just to be straightforward about it. I mean, just when I've talked to people who these lines get very blurry and things like, and where does it start? Because in some cases on the Ohio State band, there were rape, you know, allegations mm-hmm. that were sort of condoned. And so I think that it's all pretty muddy. I'm just getting at cultures within these organizations mm-hmm. can get pretty muddy on what is fun and what is being glibly talked about and what is actually then accused criminally.
Yeah, and unfortunately we're in this very tribal period of politics where, you know, I'm always defending my side no matter what, mm-hmm. or I'm always opposing the other side no matter what. And that is one of the bothersome things here is that, you know, these things come out and all of a sudden you've got this group calling for Jim Jordan to resign all of a sudden. Or you've got others, including some in Congress, saying, oh, I absolutely believe Jim Jordan. He's right about this. Well, none of you were there.
Right.
How do you know?
Yeah.
There's definitely more that needs investigated. Jim Jordan, I think, needs to come in and really explain himself and explain against, you know, talk about these very specific allegations, including, I think, one person who said that. That says Jordan told the doctor at one point, don't you try any of that stuff with me. I mean, I'm pretty sure I saw that. And I mean, Jordan, I think, has denied saying that. But
yeah.
But it's those kind of things that you need to, you know, you need to get to the bottom of.
Jordan obviously was probably going to be a favorite on the campaign trail for his colleagues and others. There's calls not only for him to resign, but calls for Ohio lawmakers, for Republican candidates like Dave Yost to, you know, separate themselves from him. Is he off that favored list now? Are we not going to see him on the campaign trail like you might have, you know, around Labor Day, post-Labor Day?
I think so. I think that this sort of makes him not necessarily the powerhouse that he was to be on at a fair or something else. He has been, we should say, you know, the darling of the far right,
right,
one of the most powerful conservatives in the Congress, one of the founders of the Freedom Caucus, well-liked, well-respected. I went out to his district last summer when he was fighting the Affordable Care Act, and everybody to a person, just they know him personally, they like him, they trust him and respect him. So it's his brand is a little bit on the line here.
Yeah, and I think, Anne, like you said, there's a difference between the statewide races, which are a little more high profile, mm-hmm. Than maybe these more local races. So we might see him continue with the local races and
because
maybe
it's not going to attract the same kind of media attention.
Yeah, that's what I would imagine.
Statewide would, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe in other states as well, far right districts in other parts of the country.
And we've seen grow, you know, we've seen for the past 3 years. I mean, people are going to believe what they want to believe. The facts will make no difference for a lot of folks. And so, you know, regardless of what comes out, Jim Jordan is going to have a big base of support, particularly in his district, and there's going to be a large contingent of folks who want to see him out, and it's just the way it's going to be.
The two shall meet. We will continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press. A dispatch investigation has found that CVS was getting six times the amount of money for prescription drugs through the state's Medicaid program as other comparable organizations. What's Governor Kasich is now in hot water over a possible conflict of interest with that pharmacy giant, CVS Caremark, which is their pharmacy management arm of their organization. What's the conflict of interest, Jim Siegel?
Well, we're talking about pharmacy benefit managers, yeah, which are basically the middlemen between the drug companies and the Medicaid providers. And the concern has been, and we've been doing my colleagues, Marty Schladen, Kathy Kandisky, and others have been doing a great job with Lucas Sullivan as well, doing a great job with uncovering the fact that these middlemen were put in place supposedly to save money. But what we're finding is that CVS Caremark, who has most of the business in Ohio, is making just a ton of money, hundreds of millions of dollars of money as pure profit as they, you know, the cost of the drugs, and then they versus what they reimburse, mm-hmm, the pharmacies for. It's called a price spread, and they're taking a much bigger cut than generally we see in other states.
And this is through the Medicaid program,
right?
And this is something that the state approved.
Yeah, they have. I mean, it's a system that they've set up, and that the Kasich administration has done. They claim it saves money. Now, there's been the problem is that when the administration folks went before the Joint Medicaid Board for the legislature, there was a lot of concern that they weren't being completely forthright. They weren't being completely they weren't letting everybody know about all their information. There's concerns that they came up with a report about the drug pricing plan, which the department is, you know, paying CVS millions of dollars, that they gave that report to CVS before releasing it to anybody else and made sure that CVS was able to look at it. There's been just concerns that there seems to be this very cozy relationship between the administration and CVS Caremark, and some lawmakers in particular are like, wait a second, we seem to be getting ripped off here, the taxpayers and the state all in one, and we should have a better accounting for what's going on here, and we feel like we're not being told the full truth. CBS lobbyist Bridget McAuliffe is married to Matt McAuliffe, who's Kasich's director of cabinet affairs. You've got CBS lobbyist Jason Mock, who was the Senate Republican chief of staff years and now works and continues to work with Senate Republican campaigns. You've got Margaret Scott, who worked with the a pharmacologist with the Department of Medicaid, who now works for CVS, and apparently was while she was at her state job, she negotiated a position to work at CVS Caremark. So there is definitely concerns, and this is a story that's, you know, we've written thousands of inches on this so far, and we'll write more about how this is a problem that it really seems to be. Where taxpayers are really taking a bath on this at the expense of a giant corporation.
So this all started under the Kasich administration in order to cut Medicaid costs. They moved plans into what are called managed care organizations, MCOs. And through that system, they also have PBMs, these pharmacy benefit managers. And so what it looks like, I mean, if you look at the managed care program as a whole, the Kasich administration will say they are consistently cutting costs. But as Jim mentioned, you still see groups like pharmacy benefit managers who are taking a big cut of what they do. So they're given a certain amount of money and they're told, hey, you know, sell these drugs and try to save the state money. And I guess they are, but still taking a rather large cut. I guess you could call it even like a service fee
so
for what
the
they're
state
doing.
Look good, and it looks like the state's saving money, but it could be saving a lot more money.
But they could,
if
I think that's the
pharmacy benefit managers weren't taking such a large cut.
I think that's the argument that while they're saving the state money, but I guess they could be saving even more money if they, like you said, aren't taking that much of a cut. And then, as Jim pointed out, there's an issue of transparency here where the Joint Medicaid Oversight Committee, which is known as JMOC, could know more. The state could know more. The people of Ohio could know more about what's going on here. And then it goes back to the conflicts of interest.
Yeah. And the consulting firm that the Department of Medicaid hired to do a drug pricing plan study found that CVS Caremark should be paid 95 cents to $1.90 per prescription for dispensing fees. What they're actually being paid is $5.60. That's about three to six times the amount this consultant says they should be getting paid. And that's on each of about 35 million prescriptions. And if you do the math, that's up to $160 million in additional money going to CVS that probably shouldn't be. And there's also been concerns that CVS is cutting reimbursements to smaller pharmacies. And we've been hearing a number of reports that what they'll do is they'll cut the reimbursements, and then all of a sudden 2 weeks later these pharmacies will suddenly get a letter from CVS saying, "Hey, would you like to sell?"
Meaning you obviously aren't making enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let us buy you out.
Wow.
Well, and to me, you know, sort of one of the larger arcs here is just this baffling pharmaceutical cost issue that we have as a country of why do drugs cost so much, and trying to figure out who are all these middlemen and where is the money flowing. And for this to be government money in a state that's supposedly bird dogging the cost of its Medicaid program to the point where it's a national model, it makes it really concerning.
Yeah. And one of the things revealed last week that we reported on, that the Department of Health is channeling federal HIV drug assistance dollars into a program that requires patients to get the medicines exclusively from CVS. And folks who are getting these drugs are finding problems with that, delays and drugs that aren't coming in correct, when there are much easier avenues for them to get those prescriptions filled. The state is requiring them to go to CVS. Again, yet another issue being raised why does there appear to be a cozy relationship here between the state.
I mean, if you're like at OSU, you can't get it from the OSU pharmacy.
Right.
You'd have to go to CVS.
Or if you're in a small town that doesn't have a CVS.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We've been talking about these possible conflict of interest with pharmacy giant CVS Caremark. That's their pharmacy
benefit
manager. A big go-between between the state and its Medicaid prescription program. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How has the Kasich administration responded to these questions about CVS? Are they responding at all, Jim Siegel?
Well, I wasn't there, but they were in front of the this joint Medicaid panel, mm-hmm. and they took a beating from the panel. Democrats and Republicans really took it to them. They're not happy, and you know they're defending the program as Andy said. You know, they're okay. Defending. They're saying there's cost savings and that there's there's nothing unreasonable going on here, but. Lawmakers right now, again, from both sides of the aisle are not convinced at this point, and they are looking for more answers.
As far as the transparency goes, I also was not at that JMOC meeting, but after reading reports, it seems like that is one thing that the Medicaid office says that they want to do a better job at is you know, allowing for more transparency on these reports. And I think it's also worth mentioning, I believe it's Margaret Scott, who was the former pharmacologist for mm-hmm. the Department of Medicaid, who now works with CVS. I believe that her situation is now under investigation by the Ohio Ethics Committee. So there's still an ongoing investigation as to whether there was some sort of quid pro quo with that relationship.
To be continued. There is, well, today, the payday lending bill is supposed to be coming out. It's mm-hmm. been called a compromise between the House and the Senate versions.
Yeah.
But we've seen the House version, what they passed, which was basically untouched from what was introduced. But the Senate version, we don't know. I mean, how can it be a compromise?
Well, I guess it just depends on who you're asking. I think the Senate themselves are touting it as a compromise bill. But when you ask the different sides, both the people who want strict penalties on the payday lending industry or strict rules on the payday lending industry, mm-hmm. and then you ask the payday lending industry themselves, both of them say that they really haven't seen the language yet. I mean, that was as of Friday or Saturday, so maybe they've gotten a little sneak peek now. But it seems like what the process has been is that the Senate heard a lot of testimony from both sides over the course of, I believe, 5 committee meetings in 8 days. And so they heard a lot of testimony. And I think the idea behind all of this is, OK, we heard what you have to say. Now we're going to go create a plan out of what you've said. And I think the benefit of that, the thing that kind of looks good for the Senate, is that it doesn't appear like they're working with one side or the other. It doesn't appear like they're cozying up and trying to create some sort of secretive plan with just the payday lending industry, mm-hmm. which is what they've been accused of in the past.
But we don't know because we haven't seen it yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Senate is somewhat more free to fool around with the bill because the House was under such pressure to get it through.
After the Speaker resigned amid accusations or questions.
Right.
FBI investigation into his relationship with
the payday lending industry.
So the Speaker resigned. And then pretty soon afterwards, the House, which seemed like they were going to add a lot of amendments to weaken the bill, all of a sudden dropped all those amendments and just passed the strictest bill that they had.
Yeah. And I mean, there was pretty much admission by the House. We're just going to let the Senate change this if they want to. Now, of course, the payday, the consumer advocates leading that charge being Pew Charitable Trusts, they love the bill as it stands now. They think it's a great bill.
How it came out of the House.
Yes.
Yeah.
They think that's a great bill. It actually matches up a lot with the proposed constitutional amendment that they are pushing that they'd like to see on the ballot in November of 2019. Again, another one of the big catalysts pushing this along right now is the threat of that going to the ballot and the knowledge among most parties that if that does go to the ballot, it's very likely to pass because just based on what happened 10 years ago. I mean, the payday industry 10 years ago tried to stop a law and they outspent the supporters, you know, more than 10-1 and they got slaughtered at the ballot. So they know that it would be near impossible to stop it. But Pew right now is seems to be they seem to be pretty happy with the way talks have gone the last week or so. It seems as though they believe that the Senate Republicans are now coming around to their mm-hmm. point of view on mm-hmm. this. And you know, you mentioned the word compromise at the beginning. You should always be leery using the word compromise in the payday lending debate, because they're from, you know, I've covered this issue for over 10 years. There's really no such thing that I've ever seen. You either pass a bill that the payday industry is going to like, or you pass a bill that the consumer advocates are going to like. There is very little in between that you can pass that both sides are going to say, this is fine, we'll live with this. And that's just the way it's been.
How fast are they supposed to take action on this?
If they can get something done today, and it's possible, later this week or next week, they'll.
Yes.
They
could vote as soon as this week.
I've been hearing that they plan on having a session day tomorrow.
Yes.
To vote on it.
Okay.
But I mean, that's all up in the air. We're talking about crafting legislation, so with that, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the committee itself is interesting. There are some definite payday lending supporters on the committee, mm-hmm. Senator Bill Coley being the most vocal. But there are some on that committee, as some Republicans as well, who really were not happy with the kind of changes that Senator Matt Huffman was talking about making, and that it was that the consumer advocate said would have severely weakened the bill and basically implementing a lot of things that the payday industry was advocating for, things that they say look like reform but really don't do anything at the end of the day to help people afford their payments and get out of the debt trap.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago there was an interesting gambit by the Senate Democrats who tried to force a vote out of committee even though they knew that the Senate Republicans were going to hold off on any sort of vote. And so there was this little parliamentarian motion in committee to try to force a vote. And you could see that the Republican caucus was sort of scrambling around just to make sure that everybody understood how to vote. Even the people who want to see this bill pass decided to table that amendment just to give it some more time. But I think you could see in that action, like what Jim's saying, is that there are several Republicans on that committee who don't mind the bill the way it is now, who probably don't want to see a lot of changes.
Who like
clamping down on the industry.
Regulation on the industry, right?
And it's mm-hmm. interesting that they have rushed in some ways back to the table here
yeah.
because, you know, Larry Obhoff, the Senate president, had sort of said, we're all going to leave. We're not able to get
right.
this vote. And I'll bring them back by September or so, rather than waiting until the lame duck session, because normally they would have been done at the end of June. And so September was the for sure date they were coming back. And all of a sudden, here it is.
But whatever they do, the House still has to approve any changes, and they're not coming back. Right.
The House could come back. They have okay. some. Well, not until September.
Yeah.
But yeah, they would. But then. But I think, you know, the Senate and the Senate president, this is a hot issue right now, a mm-hmm. hot political issue. And they would rather see their end of it finished and off their plate. Mm-hmm. And so they can finish off the rest of the summer without hearing from people about why haven't you taken action on this, hearing from editorial pages, why haven't you taken action on this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would benefit them politically to do that. And again, just a quick summary of it all. The issue we're talking about here is basically low dollar amount, high interest loans. We're talking about like 2 week loans, three or 4 week loans that are that have interest rates anywhere from 300 to 600% annual interest. And the problem is that many people who take out a $500 loan today and you use it to pay off, let's say, a car repair, you will not have $500 in 2 weeks when that loan comes due, and you'll be forced to re-up the loan again and pay the fees again. And that is the debt cycle that mm-hmm. that consumer advocates say we need to stop, because we're taking advantage of low-income borrowers who have no other options, who are forced to pay. By the time it's over, they end up paying practically as much in fees, if not more, than they actually borrowed to begin with.
And if, again, going back to like the committee hearings, you could tell that both sides were saying things that the lawmakers sort of took an interest in. I remember even hearing Pew say, I think right now as the bill stands, it limits the loan amount to a certain amount. It's either $500 or $1,500. And Pew's,
it's $500 at the moment.
And Pew's saying you can raise that a little bit if, as long as you, you know, adjust it here and there. So the Pew seems like they're willing to compromise here and there. But what they want to do is exactly what Jim's saying, is end these debt traps. And one of the provisions in the bill that I think even that a lot of Republicans like is the idea of taking a look at somebody's actual income and basing off how much they can loan out. So somebody, it's feasible that to look at how much somebody's making to see, oh, they actually have the ability to pay this off mm-hmm. in the amount of time
like
they get
when
in.
You buy a house or something like that, anything mm-hmm. like that.
That's what I was right. just going to say, right? You don't want to get a loan that's
beyond your means. Right, right.
And there, and a key, right now, the way the bill is set up, if you took out a $500 loan under the bill, that you could be charged up to $250 in interest because right. it allows up to 50% of the loan in interest and fees. So there's a $250 that could go to the lender. The difference is there's no more 2-week loan. They would have to determine what's 5%. You can only make payments of 5% of your monthly income. So let's say that probably stretches this loan out for an average borrower to 6 months. Mm-hmm. So now you have 6 months to pay off what is essentially $750 rather than 2 weeks to pay off $535 or $550. Mm-hmm. That is, to the consumer advocates, that is a much more reasonable expectation that someone who takes out a loan like that would be able to pay that off in that amount of time rather than having to re-up the loan over and over again and get charged more and more fees.
Pew also argues that these are the sort of laws that have been implemented in Colorado and that they're working as well.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. To our reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio is trying to get back the $200 million it put toward the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, now defunct. But the founder, Bill Lager, was the one that would have to pay it back. The for-profit company was inflating student attendance and taking in taxpayer dollars for years. Lawmakers recently passed legislation to study e-school funding models, but the question is, will this be enough to show lawmakers where they went wrong? To help us talk about that, still with us, Andy Chow, reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel. Jim, you've been covering ECOT pretty carefully for a long time now. How much money could ECOT's founder potentially have to pay back? It's not just the state of Ohio he owes, right?
Well, it's a little hazy right now as to what he will actually what they could actually go after him for and what he'll have to pay back. I mean, he owes the state of Ohio more than $50 million still of the $80 million he was told to repay for unverified enrollment. I think he owes about $1.5 million to the Department of Job and Family Services. I think that's for unemployment comp claims, and then he owes a little piddly amount to for textbooks. I think to Owens Community College, but. The issue is that over the years, the 18 years it was in existence, ECOT paid about $200 million to Bill Lager's two companies, his management company, Altair, which ran the day-to-day operations of ECOT, and IQ Innovations, which was the software provider for ECOT. Bill Lager owned both of those companies. Now, if you're sitting at home thinking, gosh, that seems like a strange conflict of interest to have the founder of ECOT then have all the business interests that ECOT works with, well, guess what? You've discovered what many folks have been saying for over a decade. However, this is now just coming to light and is now they're now going after it. This is the system that has been set up. This was set up long ago in Ohio.
And the criticisms that, have you said they, and the criticisms they've been launched were there. For leveled for 10 years.
Yes.
Now,
at least. The people who founded these schools they'd name the board members, mm-hmm. then they'd run the companies and have a financial interest in the management companies. David Brennan with White Hat Management right. was the other big one. Mm-hmm. who's done similar things, and there's a very cozy relationship between the companies making money off of this and the folks who are supposedly running the school.
Right. And so what's happening now is that everything is sort of coming to a head in an election year because the two last reviews of the ECOD attendance did finally sort of say that there was inflated attendance and ask for the money back. And so Republicans who control every level of our state government are working on responding to those last two reviews, including a whistleblower who came forward and said that internally they had been manipulating data and that he had been privy to these conversations internally where the software that was used after the first $60 million was assessed was then used and tweaked so that it would maximize the amount of attendance and that they ran data runs and things like that to make those numbers higher. So now Republicans sort of it can no longer be ignored. Auditor Davios has come out citing this whistleblower, among other findings. Attorney General Mike DeWine, who's running for governor, has is now trying to recoup that money. But it comes at a time when the Democrats are trying to use this as a political theme throughout the
took you
season.
So long theme. Mm-hmm.
Right, and the theme of turning a blind eye, taking campaign contributions, really up and down the line from the DeWine Husted team to all the other Republicans, how much money it was. And then those who are running for the lower ticket offices who were in the legislature, such as Keith Faber, taking money and overseeing these various bills. So it's become a real political hot potato.
It's a tough position for Republicans because they can either do nothing or they can try to look tough on ECOT, and then, like you said, the Democrats can say, wait a minute, by looking tough on ECOT, you're doing things that we've been calling for years now. To jump into the nitty-gritty of all of this, as it's been mentioned, there have been unverified student participation numbers. So the state, the Ohio Department of Education, is clawing back what's left of the $80 million that they wanted, and it's more than $60 million now. ECOT's closed and ECOT's saying, sorry, we can't give you that $60 million. We don't have it. And the state's saying, no, we gave $200 million to your subsidiary. We gave $200 million to Altair and IQ.
Which happened to be owned by the founder.
And so in order to get that money, in order to go after that, Mike DeWine has to basically admit in a legal document that that's a pattern of corrupt activity. So that's the bind that the AG's in right
and
now to go after that money.
This.
He put it down in. Okay. There's a legal court filing that's been submitted that says Bill Lager's the founder of ECOT. He also operates IQ and Altair. That is a pattern of corrupt activity. That's why we're going after that money.
It's basically a civil RICO.
It is called a civil RICO.
Uh-huh. You know, there's triple damages involved there. I mean, the case that Mike DeWine says that there was a ruling down in Cincinnati on a charter school case where a similar set of circumstances with a smaller issue. But, I mean, they found in favor of the state, and they ordered these folks who owned these other companies to pay triple damages. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this could get real expensive real fast if this is allowed to go forward. I mean, and the attorney general is arguing that he had a fiduciary, Bill Lager, the founder, had a fiduciary responsibility to ECOT, but that he could not possibly uphold that because of his positions owning these for-profit companies. That his position as an agent for ECOT meant that he was not allowed to have this direct financial interest in making money off of ECOT. But again, as Democrats say, this has been going on for well over a decade, and there's been little to nothing done to curb it up until the last couple years.
And Mike DeWine has been attorney general for
7 years.
Two terms.
Two
It'll
terms,
be two terms
right?
by the time he... by the time this term ends. Okay, all right. So he's been around for a while.
And so just to add some clarification, because you're still going to hear Democrats say Mike DeWine needs to go after Bill Lager. But that's because there's a difference here. We're talking about a civil case, And Democrats still want DeWine to go after Bill Lager criminally for criminal investigations. And that's where DeWine says that he doesn't have jurisdiction.
Is it criminal, though, because the law permitted him to do it?
Well, this particular part of it is not going to be criminal. The part that's criminal that or that could be criminal that Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien and the U.S. Attorney's Office are looking at right now is the idea that they fraudulently created student enrollment data and sent that to the state in order to get paid more money, and that they knowingly were doing
sending fraudulent data.
That's where the criminal part of this could come in. That'll be a separate track from this. DeWine, as Andy just said, says he can't. That's not his area. But there are definitely there's still some. That's still an outstanding question. Dave Yost forwarded those charges over for potential prosecution for fraud charges. And they're still looking at whether to pursue those.
And remember, too, that the tentacles of ECOT are so they reach so far that, Ron O'Brien also had to recuse himself from the investigation because a member of his staff was married at the time to the principal of ECOT. And so he had to punt his piece of this, which the Franklin County prosecutor always looks at these state government related criminal charges or potential criminal charges. And so he had to punt to an independent investigator as well because of an ECOT conflict of interest. So it just goes to every level here that the Republicans are trying to get tough on ECOT right now in an election year. And it's just revealing more and more exactly everything that ECOT was controlling.
Is Mike DeWine the only one that's going to be dealing with this on the campaign trail?
No.
I think Auditor Yost is going to take a lot of heat. I mean, he's spent maybe really the past 2 years trying to build a persona of being tough on ECOT, but before then he has taken a lot of campaign contributions, which he has now donated, and he spoke at ECOT's graduation. He gave ECOT an auditor of
three times
he spoke at graduation, and he gave ECOT an auditor, a state auditor's award for good bookkeeping, so that it's gonna land tough on him as well.
And John Husted has been a defender of charter schools,
running with as lieutenant governor with
and Keith Faber was the very powerful Senate president at times when Democrats were calling for more rigorous legislation, sort of reining in ECOT.
They're definitely, I mean, you can definitely look back and see times where the Democrats and some Senate Republicans like Peggy Lehner were trying to push for some more reform against ECOT, and those attempts were pushed away and different sort of moves and tricks.
And there were some pro ECOT amendments that were floated at times in the recent years that there's some who say that Keith Faber was behind and was trying to get into bills and was trying to help them out, but they were stopped by others who are not pro ECOT.
And we should say he's running for state auditor.
Yep.
State auditor,
and that's who's running for auditor, which would look at these things.
And Dave Yost is running for attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the monkey move up thing going on right now. We have got about 1 minute left. Besides payday lending, anything else? As long as they're in town, is there any other kind of things that they're up to?
Well, they left some things on the table. Mm-hmm. A stand your ground bill was kind of interesting that they didn't pass that. And in fact, Kasich wants to go the other way around and kind of get some laws passed, this package of bipartisan gun laws that they also are kind of ignoring. And so guns will be something that's hanging out there in the fall.
Yeah, and outside of the State House, I think we're going to hear a lot more from Mike DeWine and Rich Cordray. I think they're going to get more specific on their platforms. And I have a feeling,
Rich Cordray being the Democratic nominee for governor, right?
Right. And I'm sure we can all see this coming, but Medicaid expansion and what each candidate's going to do with Medicaid expansion is going to be big.
And we have a special election in the 12th Congressional District.
That's right. Coming up, early voting starts tomorrow.
Yes.
And in Ohio.
You'll be hearing more and more about Republican Troy Balderson and Democrat Danny O'Connor. Connor.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today to get me back on top of what's happening. after my vacation. Julie Carr Smythe, reporter for the Associated Press, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks as well.
Thanks, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.